The Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. We've got the Justin Kaufman in the studio. We've got the Richard Roper in the studio. And Richard Roper is sponsored by Arkadek and all of his reviewing. And I got to turn Richard's mic on so we can actually hear from him there.
Thanks, Arkadek.
Nope, still no. Now?
Thanks, Arkadek.
Now it's working now.
There it is. Yeah, it's working now.
That's fantastic. Got a couple bugs on that. Hey, Rich.
Guys. How you doing, man?
I saw
your social media post that, like, hey, you got so much going on.
I think... The most reviews I've ever written in 1 week. I wrote 11 or 12 this week. So we're going to pick and choose, guys. Right. So I thought we'll start off with a couple of the big ones. Men in Black International. It's like with Mission Impossible, but they put that colon in the middle. Mission Impossible, more money for crews. This is Men in Black colon International.
But no Will Smith.
No Will Smith, no Tommy Lee Jones. Spoiler alert, too, for people who are wondering. They don't show up at any point in this movie, okay? I'm going to spoil it for you because I don't want you to see this movie anyway. You know, the first Men in Black movie was 20 years ago. It's amazing when you think about that. And at the time, the special effects were really cool. And what I liked about the first one in particular was that Tommy Lee Jones played it as straight as if he were playing Lieutenant Gerard in The Fugitive, right? You know, and which made it so funny. And then Will Smith was doing his Will Smith thing, you know, the brash young kid who was learning at his feet. But that gave the story some heft, you know? It made it kind of, in a weird way, it was funny, but also like, okay, maybe these Men in Black are really out there with the neuralizers. Problem here this time around with Chris Hemsworth, a.k.a. Thor, and Tessa Thompson, who was in the last Thor movie.
A.k.a. Valkyrie.
Right. Who I like a lot. I think she's terrific. She's also in the Creed movies, for people who don't know that, the Michael B. Jordan love interest, if you will. She's wonderful in that. Chris Hemsworth, in particular, is so intent on showing us how funny he is, and he can be funny. It kind of reminded me of like when Roger Moore was sinking the Bond movies. Remember that?
I liked Roger Moore.
Daniel Craig resuscitated it. Even Pierce Brosnan in a way, but especially Daniel Craig, because again, he was, you know, he gave us the gritty Bond living in a world where there was real peril. And if you've got Chris Hemsworth, who's like beyond the perfect looking human being, and all the humors about how he can just wink at the aliens, and he even has like interspecies, you know, romances and stuff, we lose all the fun of the action, and the action's kind of disappointing.
I feel like with Chris Hemsworth, we've seen him now in Ghostbusters. We saw him in the Avengers movies playing Thor.
It was in the Vacation reboot.
Yeah, it feels like Hollywood loves that he's funny.
Yeah,
and they're getting away from the fact that he made his name on being an action star.
Yeah, and he is a great action star. And Justin's absolutely right. And you just know that he's sitting there saying, "You know, I'm very funny in Australia. When I was coming up, I was on soap operas and game shows, and I was much funnier than just good looking." And they all go, "Okay, Chris. Okay, I want to be like The Rock meets Arnold meets Adam Sandler. Give me some of those projects." Exactly. And they're giving them to him.
Like, it works.
And that's fine, but this lacks any heft. I give it 2 stars.
Yeah. All right.
And I think I'm being kind on that. It's one of those franchises. It's been almost 10 years since the last one, and the last one wasn't very good.
Mm-hmm.
It feels a little desperate on Hollywood's
part. Okay, the one part about what grabbed my attention was that both of the stars do play off each other in different movies. Meaning Bethesda and Chris are in Avengers. They were in the Ragnarok. I was thinking in history, I was trying to roll back, like, are there points where people were stars in other movies where they ended up in different
franchises? It's interesting, because in both, well, in his case, you know, he's been pretty well known. Tessa Thompson's got a great career going. She's also in the Westworld on the HBO.
Yeah, right.
I mean, she's wonderful. I still say on the rise in terms of her career. I think in this case, it's more just coincidence. I do want to share a clip from here.
Oh.
This contains some of the best dialogue from Men in Black International.
Press the button. Turn it up a few.
That's it.
Oh, great.
That's our clip there.
Wait,
for
so
you.
She's a woman in black?
Yes. Yeah. And for,
even in the Men in Black, and she's a woman in black.
Yes, and for the second time in as many weeks, we get the, you know, obligatory, seems like it's crowbarred in, patting themselves on the back, feminist statement. First, we got it with X-Men, where the characters goes, "What about the X-Women?" And now in Men in Black, they go, "What about the women in black?" And then, we're working on it. It's like, okay, we get it.
He's
a super feminist. How much did Chris Hemsworth make as opposed to Tessa Thompson? Let's talk.
That would be an interesting comparison.
So stay away from that one. 2 stars, guys.
The heck away from it.
Do you want to talk about Late Night?
Yeah.
Now, this is interesting, too, because we have another Thompson, Emma Thompson, who's also in Men in Black International, and if you happen to see clips from the two movies, you'll note that she has the exact same haircut, just different color. So you know she did these movies like in the same month. Now, this one we like. I'm going to tell you that in advance. I'm giving 3 stars to Late Night. And we love them. I love Mindy Kaling.
I do,
I just
too.
Think she's terrific.
She's a favorite.
And as you guys may know, she wrote and produced this, and it's loosely based on her own experiences, because when she was 22 years old, She was flat out, she'd be the first one to say this, she was a diversity hire on The Office as a writer. They had all white men, and they looked around and said, you know, we should change this. She joined the staff as a writer, soon became a featured player, became a producer on the show. In this movie, she plays someone whose last job was at a chemical plant, but Emma Thompson plays a late-night talk show host. Even though it's a woman, she's very Letterman-esque. She's in her, like, 29th year. She doesn't want to have the YouTube stars on her show. She won't go out on the streets and do the bits anymore. She's resting on her laurels. And she's told one day, you know, you have all white men and you've never had a woman on your writing staff. So she hires Mindy Kaling, who's got all the check marks. And here's a clip. This is Mindy's first day on the job as a writer for the late night talk show.
I don't know. Maybe I should move back to Pennsylvania.
Can I give you some advice? You need to shut up.
Excuse me?
If you hear something you don't agree with, you have to resist the urge to give your opinion.
I will not be marginalized by the iron fist of white privilege that pervades this work environment.
I am not trying to silence your strong female Indian woman of color spirit. Hashtag me too, trans is beautiful, blah, blah, blah. You're still a new writer with no experience. You need to stop giving advice and write something. You're a writer, so write.
I love that scene.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
feels
you can
very
tell,
honest.
You know, they're making their statements here, but, you know, really doing it within this kind of soft. It's really almost like a rom-com. It's, you know, plays like that, although the romance is really just between Mindy and her job and her situation. Love her.
The trailer has a great scene where she walks in and she goes to sit down. And they, like, you can't sit there. Someone else is sitting there. She's like, I'll just take the trash can. I'll sit on the trash. It's very comfortable.
Yeah, exactly.
Sits on the trash can. I'm like, that's great.
Good
that's
for
funny.
Her.
And Emma Thompson is great as this cold, distant, you know, institution who's basically being forced out. And, like, she'll go into the writer's room and says, like, you know, well, where's Malcolm? And they're like, he passed away from pancreatic cancer 6 years ago. Oh, did I send a card? I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah. So 3 stars for that.
Three stars.
I like the fact that it does make points about, you know, Me Too and women in the workplace, but it's also just really kind of light and entertaining. And Mindy Kaling, I mean, she reminds me of, like, Mary Tyler Moore throwing
her hat in the air in this role.
She's so fun and so
and
cool.
And where do we
so
see
smart.
This? Is this major theater
this
release?
Yeah, this is a major theatrical release. I hope it does well. I hope people see Late Night instead of Men in Black International, which will dominate the box office. But I don't think it's going to be a huge hit. Dark Phoenix bombed last week as well because it was terrible.
Good. It's good to hear that, like, you know, they don't just
sometimes word of mouth and critical consensus can help.
I agree.
Steer people to the good movies. Go to the good movies.
Go to the good movies. They'll make more of them.
Go to the light. Go to the light.
Stay away from the Men in Black. The Men in Black.
Exactly. Thank you.
All right. Shaft. Do we want to go to that one?
Okay. Let's do that.
Samuel L. Jackson is in Shaft.
Yeah. You know, here's
20 years
one.
Later.
No, here's another one. It's been almost 20 years since the Samuel L. Jackson Shaft, which was in 2000. Now, the original Shaft was 1971, Richard Roundtree, and, you know, he was a bad mother, shut your mouth. And that was actually a really well done neo noir kind of, you know, blaxploitation, maybe the best of all those films. The only thing that's really held since then is the theme song, which is still the Oscar winning score from Isaac Hayes. So now we're at the third generation Shaft, and we've got young JJ. His dad, he has not seen since he was a baby. And young, the third Shaft generation, this kid is MIT educated, you know, very kind of soft, very different from his dad. But now he needs his dad's help in solving a crime.
What is wrong with you?
You picked up a bat.
You can't beat up a woman.
Why not?
Because she's a woman. That's like misogynistic.
You the one being misogynistic. I ain't mentioning her gender.
Okay.
I'm an equal opportunity ass whooper.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. This movie is homophobic, Islamophobic, misogynist for sure, and just dumb as well.
So overall, a summer blockbuster.
It'll go great globally. It's so bad, and it's so disappointing to see this because, you know, you do have you know, the three generations of chefs. Kind of an interesting idea, but the script feels like it was dusted off from 1975. And then they take, like, shots at people that don't need to deserve a shot. Sam Jackson's character keeps questioning his son's sexuality because the kid is well-dressed and nonviolent. And he actually calls him Don Lemon at one point. Because
no
that's an
way.
Insult, I guess. Because Don Lemon's gay and well-dressed. And I'm like, how did they let that get into this movie?
How?
Don Lemon is a bad mother. Shut your mouth. So, 1.5 stars. Shaft is terrible.
Oh, gee. This is, I mean, I'm sorry.
You can hear it drip from your voice.
Oh, man, I couldn't believe it.
The disappointment.
My buddy Michael Phillips, my cohort over at the Trib, he didn't even review it. Because there were so many movies this week. He goes, you know what? I'm not even going to bother with it, but it's really bad. That's it. That was his
Does
tweet
that
review.
Happen?
Michael actually did. He's like, I can't write about it. You write about it.
it's
city's
on
all
you.
Yours,
it's
Rich.
It's on you.
Yeah, I'm like, okay.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a break here, and then we'll come back with more of Richard Roper's reviews. We still have the zombie movie with Bill Murray. I don't quite understand, but
the
you'll
dead
just,
don't like, die.
Dead don't die. A zomcom, as it's
yes!
called, right? From a rom-com to a zomcom. Yes! We'll find out if Bill Murray is good coming up, but let's check in, find out what's happening. The bottom of the hour in the WGN news. Oh, my gosh. All right, well, Richard Roper.
Go see Rocket Man! Sorry.
doing his reviews.
Yes.
And you said the non-Will Smith Men in Black with a woman in black gets 2 stars.
Yep.
Late night rom-com, 3 stars.
Yes,
Mindy
we like that one.
Shaft, 1.5.
Terrible.
Samuel Jackson, awful, 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 awful. The Dead Don't Die,
Dead
a
don't
zombie
die.
Movie
it's
with Bill
zombie.
Murray.
Com, as you mentioned Zom-com. Here. So Jim Jarmusch, who's always been an interesting director. Justin, I know you love his work, right? He went to a movie called Coffee and Cigarettes, yeah. which if you have a chance to check it out, it's this amazing series of vignettes, including one in which Bill Murray plays Bill Murray, but he's working as a busboy, a waiter in a diner.
And Murray right. always goes back to Jim Jarmusch.
He loves
They've
him.
Always
yeah.
work together.
So The Dead Don't Die is a zombie movie. It's set. It's very much kind of like almost like a Twin Peaks type of thing. It's very deadpan in more ways than one. The fun conceit here is that Adam Driver and Bill Murray, okay, they play the small town cops in Centerville.
What a combo.
And because of fracking, the earth has fallen off its polar axis and all kinds of weird things are happening. The sun's never going down. And now that the undead are starting to walk the earth. And one of the cool things in the movie is that Adam Driver is aware of the fact they're in a movie from the start. Bill Murray, not so much. So at one point, Adam Driver keeps saying, like, I got to... feeling something's really going to go wrong. And Bill Murray's like, why do you keep saying that? He goes, because I read the whole script. And then Murray says, you got the whole script? I only got the sides with my part in it. So I don't know what happened. So okay. it's one of those kind of
Classic,
things if you're into
yeah.
it.
A little meta.
Yeah, very yeah. meta. So here's a scene. Okay. Chloe Sevigny also plays a young police officer. She has no idea she's in a movie. And this is her with Adam Driver and Bill Murray as things are starting to go really bad and zombies are starting to walk the streets.
Guys, shouldn't we be telling each other that it's all going to be okay? That this will all go away like a bad dream? Ronnie?
Gee, Mindy, I'm not sure I can say that.
Cliff? Please?
It's all gonna be okay, Mindy. Maybe it'll all just go away like a bad dream.
I doubt it.
Because he's read the script! So, you know, if you're zombied out, this is kind of a fun, like, almost antidote to that because of the fact that they're kind of aware of it and still has some really
And it plays,
fun
it
social.
Works like that?
It does.
That can go one way or
that
the
can
other.
Get old. I mean, yeah. it could be a great SNL skit, right. Justin. You're absolutely right.
Uh-huh.
And it does have some, it, you know, in the social commentary, gets a little heavy-handed at times, but, you know, who better than Steve Buscemi to play a crazy, racist, paranoid farmer wearing a red hat that says, Make America White Again, just in case you're not getting the message at one point in this thing. But I liked it. Dead Don't Die. 3 living stars.
Right.
3 stars.
All right. So go see The Dead Don't Die with Bill Murray. He's always good. We love Bill Murray.
Love Bill.
And then also see Late Night.
Yes.
Avoid The Shaft. Avoid the Men in Black. Both
exactly.
of those. Goodbye.
Exactly.
No way.
There you go.
We have just a few seconds here. Euphoria on HBO.
Yeah,
I've seen so many trailers of this. This is heavily promoted.
Yeah. And we can talk about this maybe a little bit more tomorrow as well. But Euphoria is an HBO series. It's getting the Parents Television Council is warning everybody about it. They haven't seen it. It's a limited series about teenagers who are deep into sex addiction, drug addiction, violence. It's very much like a movie called Kids from the 90s or Less Than Zero from back in the day.
Yeah.
It's the kind of movie, you know, like a lot of parents are going to see it and really want to check out their kids' phones, even though they know that they shouldn't, but maybe they should. I think it's great. If you watch it and see it all the way through, it is not glamorizing or glorifying drug use or any of this stuff. You got to watch it all the way through. And Zendaya, who started off as a Disney Channel
yes.
star,
Gosh.
And then we've seen her in the Spider-Man movies and other things, is the star of this, and it is a revelation how good she is. She is
Greatest
on her way
showman.
To becoming a huge star.
Greatest you know? Showman, too. That's right.
Greatest Showman.
She's
yeah, I mean, she's only 22 or 23.
Gosh.
So she's young enough that
is
we
that
believe
it?
Her as a 17-year-old. But also veteran enough to handle the heavy, heavy scenes here. And she is Emmy-worthy in this film, mm-hmm. in this series.
It's hard to watch because it's so real.
Oh,
and
man.
That it's like what's growing up. What it's like to grow up today.
In this day
is
and
that...
age. We get a lot of backstories on these troubled kids, finding out what happened to them each time we go back to when they were 11 years old and we find out certain things about them that kind of explain why they're on the path they're on. But, I mean, this is intense stuff. There was a young actor, rapper, who actually... quit the show halfway through filming because he didn't feel comfortable with some of the scenes he had to do with some violence toward women and stuff. And he goes, I know it's acting, but it's not for me. And they actually had to replace him and reshoot the scenes. And I respect that, too. You know what I mean? But again, if you check it out, Euphoria on HBO, it's not just this gratuitous heavy R-rated sensationalistic look at teen life. It's a slice of reality.
Is it something appropriate for teens?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. I mean, if you're 16 or 17, you know about this life. Not every single teenage character here is on drugs or, you know, promiscuous. There are a lot of other storylines as well. And Maude Apatow, who was the daughter of Judd Apatow and Leslie Mann, is terrific in this as well, young actress.
All right.
Really good cast.
Richard Roper, we'll see you tomorrow as well.
Awesome.
Thank you for that more to talk about tomorrow because, as you said, very busy week it is. It's The Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. It's Friday. We've got Justin Kaufman Richard Roper in today. And the Carnival Wagon has already rolled, and it is a good Friday, and we're very happy for that. Now, we're also happy that Richard's here because we have several movies to talk about. And one of them is of local significance, there's a lot of buzz around it, but I don't know what to make of it. 16 shots. And those of us who live here will associate that with the Laquan McDonald shooting that changed our city.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what this documentary is about. It premieres tonight on Showtime. If you have Showtime, you can start watching that tonight. And they'll be playing, you know, for the next month or so. It's a really, really strong film. I'm giving it 3.5 stars. For those of us, especially a lot of us, you know, paid attention to this if we were in the media or if you were somebody just involved in, you know, in activism or just a news consumer. I'm not going to say there's a ton of new information, although there is some. But this is a national, you know, piece of work. It's intended for a mainstream audience. And I like what the filmmakers did here. They kind of laid it out as a police procedural. We know what's going to happen, although a lot of people that are watching this documentary are not going to know what's happening. But, you know, I even kind of forgot, because that was, I want to say 2014, the fall, October of 2014. And when that shooting occurred on the local news and in the papers and on the radio the next few days, it was, you know, the official line was that this kid, Laquan McDonald, troubled kid, and he was, and he came from a, you know, a tough background.
Yeah.
He had a knife. He was being, you know, kind of followed by police, and he lunged for the police. That was the official line, and they had no choice but to open fire.
It was almost dismissed. It was almost another shooting here.
It absolutely was, Justin.
It was dismissed.
It absolutely was.
I agree.
Mean, you know, justifiable homicide. All the police reports had almost the exact same wording. There didn't seem to be anything there. And then it was, you know, time went by, and Carol Marine is one of the many people featured in this, and she mentions that within 6 months of that shooting, the city of Chicago paid out a $5 million settlement to the Laquan McDonald's family. And as you guys know, and a lot of our listeners know, the city can drag its feet on settlements and shootings for years.
This one seemed very speedy, and it was almost sort of under the radar in the way it was handled, and it was a large judgment for something like that to happen.
And obviously part of the settlement was the family then agreed not to talk about the case. So you didn't see Laquan McDonald's family out there. You know, you eventually started seeing various activists and some relatives, including a granduncle or stepuncle who's a reverend. But it was a while before the interest in the case, you know, kind of came back to the media. There's a freelance writer who writes for Slate and another number of other publications who started hearing about this dash cam video. And then, and as the film points out, and they're not quite sure if it was somebody making a mistake or what happened, the attorney for the McDonald family, for the Laquan McDonald's family, asked to see the video, and they sent it in a file. And I think they were supposed to just respond and say, well, we'll let you know when we can let you see it. They sent the video to the family. The family attorney, he then had the video. He let the and that's when the media started saying, when are we going to see the video? When are we going to see the video?
And there are a number of Freedom of Information Act requests, and they said Anita Alvarez's official line was, well, we still have an active investigation.
Right.
Nobody wanted to release it yet. It'll come, but not yet.
And Gary McCarthy, friend of the show, obviously, who was the police superintendent at the time, said, listen, he did not have the power to discipline these officers. There was a certain kind of procedure that goes there where he couldn't just, you know, say, oh, I saw the video. You're off the squad. There's different, you know, procedurals. Rahm Emanuel early on said, hey, this was a justified shooting.
Mm-hmm. It's not clear when he saw it, but most people figure he probably saw that video within the first week. He did not talk about it. But eventually, of course, the video was made public. It was all over the news. And that's when the protests really started going. If it, that dash cam video had never been made public, they never would have brought a case against Jason.
So how far does this film go? I mean, does it go all the way through the trial and go all the things that we saw with the
police? They updated it because it was on the film festival circuit before the trial had completed. So there's footage of the trial. Jason Van Dyke, you know, Rahm Emanuel, they did not sit down for interviews, as you might expect. Gary McCarthy, to his credit, did. We have a clip here, too. There were a number of eyewitnesses who, that night, near 47th and Pulaski, were either in their cars or in the vicinity. Remember, at first, people thought it happened in the Burger King parking lot. Yeah. The police confiscated 83 minutes of tape, just sort of disappeared. But as we know, obviously, it was on the street. And we've got a clip here. Here's a woman who was in her car and saw what happened and absolutely wanted to tell police what happened, and she talks about her experience with that.
The detectives called me over and they took us to the precinct. They separated us in three different rooms.
They brought me to a small office and they started questioning me and asking me what happened.
I talked to several detectives, not one, and they kept asking me the same questions over and over again. What did you see? How many gunshots did you hear? The more I kept telling them of what I saw, they were trying to make me, they would tell me stuff like, well, we're watching the video and your story does not match. And I said, well, if it doesn't match, then, and you have a video, what am I doing here? And they said, well, you know, it's not good to lie. They really wanted me to change the story about how many shots I had heard. If I didn't tell them what they wanted to hear, I definitely thought I was going to go to jail.
Wow.
That part is so chilling to me.
Yeah, and you heard a gentleman there as well, the same thing. There are three witnesses put in separate rooms, and what she's saying there is she told them this kid was not making a move toward the police officer. He kept shooting him. And she says that after the first shot, Laquan McDonald was down, and she said that she was even yelling at them, why are you shooting him? He's gone. You know, she said, as the witness, they didn't like that story. They wanted the story to be what the official police line was, at least from the start.
So is the story, is this documentary on Showtime, is it shining a spotlight on the cover-up piece of this? Is that part of the,
a lot of
really
it is,
the
a lot
focus?
Of it is about, you know, the code of silence, if you will, that, you know, a lot of police officers, well, that was in the 50s. It's different. I do think it's better and it's different now. But it was clear that from the start, there was a uniform line about what happened in the shooting, and the reports almost all had the same language from the other officers. And once we saw the video, it was clear that that was not the truth.
Yeah.
That
and then it went all the way up to the top, because it was frustrating for reporters in this town to say, wait a minute, what happened here? And what they said happened, what the official police union and police spokesperson's account of the quote-unquote facts of that scene that night do not match what happened on that videotape. And then all of the Freedom of Information Requests Act, I mean, the act requests that were stalled, and it just felt as if you kind of knew what was happening, but this documentary sort of digs down and deep in terms of figuring out how it happened.
Absolutely.
There's the news part of it, which we know in this room because we covered it, and there's a lot of Chicagoans who might be listening that didn't necessarily pay attention that much to it. But does it come through in the sense that it's a good film? Like that it's good,
it's well
shot,
it's
that
very
you see
well
some
made.
Stuff that you have,
yes, yeah. I mean, a lot of these documentaries now, they all become enamored with the drone shots. So every time you transition from one sequence to another, you see a sweeping drone shot of how beautiful the city is. We get it; there are two cities and everything. That's a little overdone,
it is.
But it's a good looking film in terms of the editing. You know, it's very well made, and the sit down interviews. You know, and again, I'll give Gary McCarthy credit. Pat Camden as well, the former spokesman, who at one point in the movie says, I don't like the way this interview is going, actually says that on camera because he's being questioned about some of the things he said. And, you know, you look at what happened there. Gary McCarthy was asked to resign, basically forced out by Rahm Emanuel. Rahm Emanuel decided not to run again. Anita Alvarez, all the people who were in the position of power, you can't say it's because of this case, but it certainly had an effect.
Certainly a contributor.
And, you know, Rahm announced he wasn't going to run just before that trial started, you know, and I think that was, you know, that was the timing there. And the trial testimony is riveting, too. You can't, it's not like we don't feel for Jason Van Dyke, certainly for his family, but, you know, when you put a defendant like that on the stand, that's kind of saying we know we're going to get a conviction against us, you know, because you rarely see that. You know, most cases they don't want to put the defendant up there. And somebody else, an onlooker, describes it, and I agree, it wasn't so much that he was, you could tell that he was terrified. And the night of the shooting, he was terrified, wrongly so, and that he shot more out of fear than any kind of premeditated hatred. And when they ask him to describe what happened, he does not do himself any favors on that witness.
This is for a mainstream audience, not for Chicago necessarily, because we know this story. Does it make Chicago look bad?
I don't think so. I really don't. I mean, you know, again, you know, as we all know, especially in this room and a lot of the listeners know, 99% of the police officers out there are good men and women who are trying to do the right thing. They got in the line of work because they wanted to do the right thing. And they are, they are our last line of defense. And they are looking out for us, protecting us, and trying to put away the bad guys. So it's not this like, the Chicago Police Department is this corrupt body that needs to be, completely stricken down. I don't think it necessarily paints the mayor, the former mayor, in a great light, because, he starts off by saying, and look, maybe he thought at the time it was justified, but boy, when it's time to pivot, nothing like this should ever happen in America, and boy, did he, Gary McCarthy got thrown under that bus so fast, So you see a lot of that, but it's not a finger-pointing, indictment of the system or the city. It's not, it touches on things. We also see, things from the standpoint of activists who's in the community who thought they never would see this day, and one of them points out that was an almost all white jury, and that tells you something about the good in people, because they deliberated and voted what they believe to be the facts of the case,
and they might not have spoke to their own experience personally, but they were able to understand that something wrong had happened here.
Absolutely.
Is it something though that Chicagoans in general, we feel like we've lived this, and so maybe this documentary
I completely get that. I can completely get, like, on a Friday night it's going to be on Showtime, a lot of people are going to say, there's a Netflix movie with Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston, I want to escape to that. I don't blame people for that at all. I never do. I could get that. I do think if you watch it, like a lot of these documentaries about crime and justice in America, you do learn things about who we are as a people, and the way it's laid out, maybe it'll happen one day, maybe not, but you can see this becoming a fictional film as well, dramatized completely, because it really is the way it's laid out and the way the case, the journalist is the hero, the one, freelance.
Right.
There was a cop that testified who was on the scene too and told the truth and said, they said, why didn't you fire your weapon? He goes, I never felt threatened. I never felt that we were being threatened.
Mm-hmm.
So it took a lot of guts to do that too.
Yeah, no question. We've got more to review. We've got a few more movies with Richard Roper, but first let's check in with Jen DeSalvo, see what's coming up bottom of the hour in the WGN News.
This week on Chicago's Best, the team is cooking up everything from the Chicago char dog to an Italian sausage. It's an all-new Chicago's Best Lynx, Sunday night at 10, WGN TV.
All right. Richard Roper is here giving us reviews. And did you give us the stars for 16 shots?
3.5 for 16 shots playing now on Showtime. Okay. I can recap real quickly. Men in Black International is terrible.
Forget about it.
Terrible.
Awful.
Late Night with Mindy Kaling and Emma Thompson's a lot of fun.
Great.
If you're looking for some light, entertaining fare. And we're going to talk a little bit quickly here about Martin Scorsese. Well, of course, everybody knows one of the great fiction filmmakers of all time, but also one of the great documentarians, if you will. He's done a lot of documentaries over the years. And he is the director of this Rolling Thunder review, Bob Dylan in 1975, who at the time could have sold out arenas, and that was around the time when a lot of bands were starting to do that, decided that he wanted to go back and play like seats, places that seated like 2,000, sometimes even smaller than that. And it was the Rolling Thunder review. He had a kind of ragtag collection of great musicians, and then different acts would join him here and there along the way. Joan Baez for a few shows. There's Joni Mitchell over there. Roger McGuinn from the Byrds. Allen Ginsberg, the famous poet, one of the great poets of the 20th century, actually joined him on the tour. And I think we've got a clip here. And this is Bob Dylan in relatively present day. He hadn't done an interview in about 12 years. But, when Marty wants to talk to you, Scorsese. So this is Bob Dylan looking back at it, and also about the fact that Allen Ginsberg, the poet, was part of this musical tour.
See, Ginsberg was like going to see the Oracle of Delphi. He didn't care about material wealth or political power. He was his own kind of king, but he wanted to play music. He had already achieved what any national poet could hope to achieve. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness. Very few poets have done that. Robert Frost, maybe. Promises to keep, miles to go before I sleep. Whitman said, I'm large, I contain multitudes. We still remember those lines today. Today's poets don't reach into the public consciousness that way. So it was remarkable that Allen had actually broken through. Nowadays, lines that people remember are lines from songs, lyrics from songs. Your cheating heart will make you weep. Don't change your hair for me, not if you care for me. I'm in the mood for love. What a difference a day makes. Ain't misbehaving. Alan wanted his lines to be remembered like that. But he was a poet. He wasn't a songwriter.
That's just Bob Dylan. This wow. is doing great. Bob Dylan. But he's like a poet deep. With himself, right? The way he talks.
Yeah,
it's
great.
It almost sounds like a Dylan song. He's fascinating. Uh-huh. Obviously a hugely influential figure. And the band was fantastic that he had playing all these great songs. There's a really cool segment. People might remember the story of Hurricane, Reuben Hurricane Carter, who was the boxer wrongly convicted of murder. Denzel Washington ended up playing him in the movie. They've got footage here of when he first started writing and performing the song and then went to the prison in New Jersey and performed it there.
Wow.
For Reuben Hurricane Carter, who was still behind bars at the time. So really cool footage. And of course, Scorsese did that great thing. All this footage has been out there forever, but not really released. And it's restored to the point where it looks like it's brand new concert mm-hmm. footage. It's from 1975. And the craziest thing of all is the fact that Bob Dylan actually drove the bus. Literally drove the tour bus. Don't you just
what?
Picture him as the kind of guy that
no.
never would have got a yeah. driver's license?
Ever.
And there he is, behind the wheel of the bus. She wrote, "We make it to Boston on time. We got about 4 hours right now." I swear. And it's not just for the cameras.
What?
He's always driving it. Bobby Dylan, Robert
he
Zimmerman
to drive
from
a bus.
Minneapolis, right? Or Minnesota, at least. And I guess he liked, yeah, he literally drove the tour bus. You know, you don't see
no.
Axl Rose driving like
no.
the Guns N' Roses.
No, but even
bus,
less
right?
so, Bob Dylan. Like, right? You just expect him to chill out and hang out.
Yeah, so 3.5 stars as well for the Rolling Thunder review. It's playing a limited release, and then it'll be out on video on demand soon.
Awesome.
But if you love that music from that time, or you're just like interested, and it's also a lot about the bicentennial and what was happening in America at the time too. He'd just gotten out of Vietnam, just gotten out of Watergate,
right.
kind of an economic downturn, and then here came this ramshackle tour bus, kind of you know giving right. people a reason to smile.
So you like that? You
I
like
did.
16 Shots, and we're going to be back just a minute here. We're going to check in though in 2 minutes, find out the news at the bottom of the hour with Jen DeSalvo.